This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. For nearly 2 weeks, thousands of union members and supporters have been protesting in Wisconsin State Capitol Madison, where Governor Scott Walker is seeking to strip most bargaining rights from the state's public employee unions. Walker's efforts have stalled so far because 14 Democratic senators have left the state, denying the Senate the quorum needed to enact Walker's proposals. Walker has stood firm, saying that without the change he seeks, he'll have to lay off 1,500 state workers. The events in Wisconsin are the most extreme example of battles unfolding across the country between government unions and financially strapped state and local governments. For some perspective on the issue, we turn to Stephen Greenhouse, the labor and workplace reporter for the New York Times. He's covered the events in Madison and union conflicts elsewhere. He's also the author of the book, The Big Squeeze, Tough Times for the American Worker. Greenhouse spoke this morning with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies.
Stephen Greenhouse, welcome to Fresh Air. There's a sense that what we're seeing in Wisconsin is a battle being joined that's been coming for quite some time. To what extent is this conflict representative of what's going on nationally between fiscally stressed officials and public employee unions?
There are two levels of fights going on in Wisconsin. One is trying to scale back the public employees' wages and benefits, and that we are really seeing across the country, literally from California and Oregon to New York and Maryland and Virginia and Florida. That's a nationwide fight because so many states have colossal deficits, caused in large part by the big recession, and they're trying to figure out how do we reduce our deficits. We try to reduce wages and benefits for our employees. The second level is in Wisconsin. The governor there is really trying to cripple the public employees' unions, and that is not a nationwide fight. That's a fight going on in certain states where there really is Republican control. And they see this as a way, weakening unions as a way both to weaken unions at the bargaining table and, secondly, to weaken unions' help of Democratic candidates in elections. So that, so the Republicans, having seen labor unions, greatly help the Democrats last November's elections, are eager to try to weaken unions' ability to help Democrats in future elections.
Now, just for context, there's a perception, at least among some, that public employees, or at least unionized public employees, have a much better deal than similarly skilled workers just about anywhere else in the economy. Is that true?
The studies I've read and some articles in my newspaper say that basically public employees earn more or less the same as private sector employees. There are studies by conservative think tanks saying that when you include benefits, public employees earn somewhat more than private sector employees. There are studies by various liberal professors and liberal think tanks saying that public sector employees earn 4 to 9% less. There's an excellent study sponsored by the bipartisan, nonpartisan Center for State and Local Government Excellence that says that public employees generally earn 4% less than private sector employees. Also, I should note, Dave, that there'll be studies showing that public sector employees generally earn more. But when you think that public sector employees generally have a much higher level of education than private sector employees, like in Wisconsin, 60% of public sector employees have college educations versus just 20% for the private sector. So that, on a certain level, explain why public sector employees earn more. And generally, public sector employees have much more longevity in their jobs. Teachers, policemen, firefighters, they often stay 15, 20, 25, 30 years on the job. So they generally develop more seniority, more experience, and therefore they are also paid more.
So maybe not such a clear picture, at least on wages and salaries. Is it fair to say that benefit packages in general are more generous for public employees or unionized
generally,
public
yes.
employees?
Yeah. Dave, generally, yes. Their benefit packages are better. I did a story a few weeks ago about cities and states trying to pare back, scale back fairly generous health benefits for retirees. And people I spoke to at the National Governors Association and the National League of Cities said, 20 years ago, it was clear that wages for public sector workers were considerably lower. So how did we compensate for that? We compensated for that by giving them better health and pension benefits. Now their wages have sort of caught up, but there's much more pressure to hold down their health and pension benefits. Now, I wrote a story the other day basically saying that their overall compensation, wages, and benefits are about the same as their private sector employees.
Now, those of us who followed the events in Wisconsin know that the governor, Scott Walker, wants to restrict collective bargaining rights for public employee unions there. What exactly is he asking for?
The governor is asking to limit collective bargaining, you know, for the state's teachers, the state's sanitation workers, for the state's, you know, nurses in public hospitals. He wants to limit their negotiation to just one issue, basic wages. So that means the unions could not bargain over things like workloads or vacations or overtime or health coverage. And he would further limit, you know, that the bargaining over wages so that unions could never get raises above the consumer price index unless in the city or the state, if they, you know, if inflation is running at 3% and a city agrees to a raise of 4% more than the consumer price index, then that would have to go to a public referendum. And I think the chances are extremely slim of a public referendum ever approving a raise higher than the consumer price index. So basically, he's telling unions, you can only bargain over one thing, and you're always going to disappoint your members because you'll never, ever be able to get more than the consumer price index in raises. And coupled to what the governor is doing, is there are several steps to weaken unions. Every single year, union members would vote on whether to decertify to quit their union. And I think because the union's role would be so limited and it would have so little power in bargaining, you know, there's a very good chance that many public sector workers would vote to quit their union. Also, the government would allow them to stop paying union dues. And I think, again, because unions would have so little power, so little role because of what the governor wants, many union members would say, why in the world should I continue paying union dues? And I think, you know, this is in many ways designed to weaken unions, as I said, both at the bargaining table and in politics.
And just to be clear, on benefits, were this to be enacted, a union would have no say on what health plan or retirement options their employees might have. That would be at the discretion of their public employer.
That's correct. Yeah, as they say in the business, these decisions would be unilateral by management. You know, and in this way, management represents the taxpayers. But the governors and the mayors and the school district superintendents could henceforth, if this is enacted, could basically dictate what's going to happen in the future on pensions and what's going to happen in the future on health coverage and how many days vacation one has and what the school day is and when people work to and the rules for transfers and what one's workload are. And there won't be a union, you know, the union would not be allowed to really negotiate any of this.
Now, one of the things we've seen in Wisconsin is that the unions have made financial concessions. They said that they will contribute more to their pensions and take wage cuts, which arguably would help Governor Walker address the budget problem, which he says is really driving this. If he can get the concessions without destroying collective bargaining, why doesn't he just accept the money?
That's an excellent question. That's what many people in Wisconsin are asking. The governor says that Wisconsin faces a $3.6 billion budget deficit over the next 2 years, and he asks for significant economic concessions from the workers. And the workers basically agreed to concessions that will reduce their take-home pay by 7%, which is a whole lot. They agreed to start paying 5.8% of their salaries towards their pensions, and they agreed to double their contribution for their health coverage from 6% of the cost to 12% of the cost. And together, that comes to about 7-8% of salary for workers, and that's a major concession. And everyone says that will make a real dent in reducing the deficit. So people ask the governor, well, the unions have sort of met you halfway. Why don't you meet them halfway by dropping your demands to essentially, you know, gut collective bargaining rights? And he says, we have to get rid of bargaining rights, weaken bargaining rights, because we need to solve our budget problems long term. And he asserts that only by weakening collective bargaining rights can they, in future years with future budgets, you know, get what they need in terms of reducing the deficits. Now, union advocates and union leaders will say there are many states with serious budget deficits, even worse deficits than Wisconsin, that aren't seeking to weaken or gut or eliminate collective bargaining. The Republican governors in Michigan and Pennsylvania face serious budget deficits, but they're not trying to eliminate collective bargaining rights. And Democratic governors like Andrew Cuomo in New York and Jerry Brown in in California and John Kitzhaber in Oregon. They have huge budget problems. They have contentious unions, but they're also not pushing to get rid of collective bargaining because they're confident that they could reason with the unions and persuade unions to do what's necessary to help balance their budgets.
Now, one of the things that unions and their supporters say is that union contracts aren't simply about economic stuff. It's about protecting workers on the job site from vindictive treatment by employers, favoritism, discrimination. And the governor says, well, you have civil service protection, which really ensures those rights anyway. Does he have a point?
Yes and no. You know, Wisconsin is one of the nation's strongest civil service laws. Unlike the civil service laws in many states, Wisconsin civil service law bars the state from firing anyone except for just cause, and that's a pretty strong standard. The civil service law does not apply to counties, cities, and school districts. So one thing the unions protest is, well, you know, the governor says, well, having a union contract isn't so important. We have the civil service laws, but those laws really only apply on the state level and provide very few protections at the local level. Second, it's, you know, if you get fired because you think of favoritism or nepotism, and you have a union contract and you want to challenge it, you know, the union will really go to bat for you. Generally, it might bring in an arbitrator, and there's a good chance you can get that overturned if you're really fired for, you know, not for just cause. But if there's no union contract and you want to appeal to, you know, the state, you know, employee relations board, generally you don't have a lawyer going to bat for you. In Wisconsin, the state employee relations board just has 22 people on its staff, and I can imagine a situation where hundreds or even thousands of workers might bring appeals saying I was suspended improperly, I was demoted improperly, I was fired improperly, and that could easily overload this board. Moreover, you know, this board will be run by appointees of the governor. And union leaders fear, many workers fear, that they're not going to get a fair shake, that, you know, this board is going to very often favor management's point of view. So, again, many workers say they're in much better shape against arbitrary treatment, against favoritism, against nepotism when they have a union contract than with civil service laws.
I've covered a few public employee labor battles in my own years as a newspaper reporter. And, well, it's clearly true that workers at the workplace have far less protection and are probably not going to get as good an economic deal. I have to say there are times when I've heard managers make a somewhat convincing case that, say for example, someone, a city, a government wants to reorganize its procurement or its information technology or fleet management. Let's say you've got, you know, inefficiently run fleet management garages in many, many different departments, and you want to centralize it, bringing into one department. To do that, you have to transfer a lot of workers from one department to another, change their work assignments, alter their schedules. Those are all conditions of work which the union has a say in and will oppose, in part because the savings might result in fewer jobs, and you just can't get it done. Managers say, as long as the union controls the shop floor, our hands are tied and we can't rearrange things. We can't create efficiencies that taxpayers deserve. I'm sure you've heard these things. Do you think they have a point?
I think, you know, many times unions really get in the way. Unions' role are to protect the interest of their members. And sometimes, perhaps often, those interests disagree with those of management, and the private sector will disagree. You know, their interests will clash with those of companies and increasing profits. And in the public sector, if a mayor says, well, we really want to consolidate these two or three municipal garages to save money and create more efficiencies, I can imagine unions saying that stinks, that will cause, you know, five of our people to be laid off. And I think in this day and age, when unions are really under fire, both in the private sector and the public sector, I think union leaders are realizing that, hey, maybe we have to become more flexible. Hey, maybe we have to become more understanding of what the needs of mayors are, of governors are. And some are getting the message, but some, I think, are still resisting very, very much because their members say, you know, don't do anything that might lead to layoffs.
This is a big fight, and there are plenty of people involved who aren't locals in Wisconsin. Who are some of the outside players that are weighing in on this battle, either both in Wisconsin and nationally?
There are many people from out of state who have gotten involved in this fight. You know, Governor Walker has repeatedly said, you know, there are all these out-of-state union leaders, union activists here. Why are they meddling? We don't really need them. And the union people say, wait a second. You know, the Koch brothers, the billionaire brothers gave $43,000 to your campaign. They've given lots of money to the Republican Party. You know, you're saying union leaders can't come in from out of state, shouldn't come in from out of state to show solidarity with their union brothers and sisters, whereas you're taking large amounts of money from out-of-state billionaires. So, as I've said, the stakes are very big on both sides. You know, Karl Rove has said to Republicans around the country, it's important to try to weaken public sector unions because they're a pillar of the Democratic Party. And to the extent Republicans can weaken public sector unions, that will really help Republicans at the polls and really hurt Democrats. So clearly Republicans around the country, you know, see electoral benefits here. But also, you know, many governors, you know, whatever the party, who are eager to balance their budgets, you know, I think they realize that if Governor Walker gets his way, that will put unions on the defensive, might force unions to be more reasonable in negotiations. I had a very good interview the other day with an esteemed professor at MIT, Tom Kokin, who said, you know, the unions, public sector unions have sometimes dug in too much, and they've dug in so much that sometimes it's turned the public against them. And public sector unions have to recognize reality more. They have to be more willing to compromise on things like, you know, consolidating operations to save state money. They need to compromise maybe on doing more to help hold down health coverage, because that will not only improve the image of unions in the public's eye, but it might forestall future governors from trying to take away their bargaining rights altogether.
I thought we should talk just a moment about the pension issue. You know, there are so many public employee pension funds in trouble across the country. I mean, their unfunded liabilities are high, meaning essentially that if you compare what the cost would be of them simply paying the benefits they owe to the employees and retirees they have, compare that to the assets in the fund, the assets don't nearly cover the cost. To what extent would eliminating collective bargaining solve the pension problem?
That's a good question. In some states, unions are allowed to bargain over pensions. In other states, they aren't allowed to bargain over pensions. In many states, even when you're allowed to bargain over pensions, under constitutional law, contractual law, you can't touch the pensions of people who are already retired, and you can't even touch the pensions of, you know, current workers, under the notion that they took their jobs with a contractual promise that they would receive pensions of X, and that to change that in midstream after they've been hired would violate the contract. But in other cities and states, and I hope I'm not being too confusing here, governments, mayors are allowed to change pensions for current employees. Now, stepping back, generally, governors, mayors, school districts are trying very hard to make pensions less generous for new workers, for future hires, because they have an absolute right to do that. And they're also often pressuring unions to get current employees to contribute more to their pensions to reduce the burden for the state.
You know, as we speak on March 1st here, I mean, the sides seem really dug in. The unions are determined to resist this effort by Governor Walker. He's saying he'll lay off people if he can't get the changes he needs. How do you see this playing out?
It's very unclear, Dave, how this will play out. The governor is really ratcheting up the pressure against the unions and against the 14 Democratic state senators who have decamped to Illinois to prevent the state Senate from voting on this to deny a quorum. So the governor is saying, look, union leaders, look, Democratic senators, I'm going to lay off several thousand people because you're not giving me the ability to cut my budget, to trim my budget the way I would like. So he's, in ways, trying to turn the 2,000, 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 people threatened with layoffs against their union. He's trying to turn them against the Democrats. The Democrats are saying, the unions are saying, we don't want these people laid off. That's the last thing in the world we want. So Governor Walker, why don't you just compromise? The union leaders will say, we've already agreed to a huge concession to, you know, an essential 7-8% cut in take-home pay on pensions and health coverage. So why don't you meet us halfway? And in that way, they maintain we could avoid any of these layoffs.
You know, one of the things that occurred to me is, as I've followed what's happening in Wisconsin, is that the call for the end of collective bargaining, particularly for state and local officials, reminds me a little bit of baseball owners in collective bargaining with players, where they're really trying to save themselves from their own mistakes. And what I mean is, if you have collective bargaining, you can always say no. You can say, I can't afford that pension. I can't afford that health care. I can't afford that wage plan. I need changes in work rules and conditions. Is Governor Walker here trying to foreclose the possibility that state and local officials will negotiate bad deals for their taxpayers?
Yes. Governor Walker basically wants to take the tools out of the hands of mayors, local governments, school districts to prevent them from ever granting wages and benefits that are too generous to unions. Because, you know, one way he does that is saying, you know, if you offer a raise higher than the inflation rate, that has to go to a public referendum, so don't even bother. Behind this, there's a lot of politics. On the one hand, it is true that many unions have spent hundreds of thousands of millions of dollars to help elect mayors or school board presidents. They've scratched that back. And then these mayors or school board presidents or county officials or city councilmen will then be nice to the unions in labor negotiations and in ways have been too generous. So, you know, there's been some unfortunate politics there. I think what's happening now on the Republican side is some Republican governors and, you know, even some Democratic governors like Andrew Cuomo say, we face these budget crises, and I think the Republicans say I can make a lot of – many Republicans believe they can make a lot of political hay with their rank and file, and especially with Tea Party folks, by really kicking and banging and beating up the public sector unions, because the public sector unions have become public enemy number one for many, many conservatives nowadays. And I think Governor Walker sees that it's just great, great politics for him to squeeze the public sector unions.
There's a huge hearts and minds battle here. I mean, you know, the partisans of unions say that, you know, Scott Walker looks like a bully here, that who has no concern for working people. People on the other side say the unions look like, you know, greedy special interests. Who's winning the public relations battle? Can you tell?
It's hard to know. Governor Walker cites certain polls saying, you know, majority of people support me. And yesterday I read a poll in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel saying that if one were to rerun the gubernatorial election in Wisconsin again, Wisconsin voters now say they would elect the Democrat rather than Scott Walker. That seems pretty damning to me. My newspaper, the New York Times, has a front page piece today based on a recent poll that shows the American public overwhelmingly opposes the notion of taking away collective bargaining rights of public sector workers. That was 60% to 33%. Democrats overwhelmingly believe that. Independents overwhelmingly believe that. Republicans, though, support taking away collective bargaining rights, but not by a huge majority. Another surprising result for me was that in the poll, you know, far more people opposed reducing wages and benefits for public sector worker than for cutting them. And a lot of people said they would prefer, you know, 40% of people responding said they would prefer to pay increased taxes than to decrease the benefits for public employees. So again, a lot of these states have Republican governors, and many Republican governors, you know, have taken the Read My Lips pledge, I will never raise taxes. They know that if they do, they're going to anger their conservative base. So they're much more eager to try to wrest concessions from public sector unions than to increase taxes. So the stakes, if the unions win in Wisconsin, Ohio, and Indiana, that will really embolden them. I think that will clearly discourage, you know, governors elsewhere from trying to cripple collective bargaining rights. If the unions lose, I think it will really hurt the Democrats in elections in those states and maybe in other states. If Governor Walker, if Governor Kasich win on this, I think it will encourage governors in other states to do likewise. It will really cow unions in many ways. I think one question mark in all this is unions are so invigorated. They feel that maybe if they even lose these fights in Wisconsin and Ohio, their people, their supporters, and not just union members, but you know, liberal church people and Hispanic groups and African-American groups are going to be so angry and so jazzed up that at the polls in 2012, they hope, they believe they might be able to swamp the Republicans in various states.
I want to ask you one more question. You know, I've covered a lot of public employee labor disputes over the years, and I find it a very tough challenge because I want to figure out what's fair. And it seems to me that, of course, people who work hard deserve fair wages and secure retirements and decent health care. On the other hand, it costs money. And if particularly if you're looking at a city or a state that might have a declining tax budget and limited resources, you have to think of what's fair for taxpayers as well. Both sides have horror stories to tell about the other. They're often hard to get to the bottom of. And it is a very tough, challenging reporting assignment, it seems to me. And I'm wondering how you found that over the years. How do you figure out what's fair?
It's very hard to know what's fair. As I was saying earlier, sometimes unions help elect the people who sit on the other side of the table bargaining with them. And I think people could say that there's an odor to that. That's not a good thing. And I think it's important, it's extremely important that governors, mayors, school board presidents don't give away the store. I mean, it's important that they maintain fiscal integrity, that they don't run up big deficits. On the other hand, public sector workers have to, feed their families. You want to make sure that public sector jobs pay enough and provide good enough benefits that you attract top-notch people. One big issue is, are pensions too generous? It's very hard to know what's fair. And this whole dispute, Dave, has become so infected and inflamed with partisan rhetoric. The Koch brothers, the billionaire brothers, have really, given lots of money to Scott Walker, and they're really, fueling the conservative fight to weaken public sector unions. The Democratic Party is really backing the unions here because, one, I think they really believe in collective bargaining, and two, they realize that if the unions are weakened, it will jeopardize the future of the Democratic Party.
Well, Stephen Greenhouse, I know it's a really busy time for you. Thanks so much for making some time for us.
My pleasure. Great to be here.
Stephen Greenhouse spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies. Greenhouse covers workplace and labor issues for the New York Times. Coming up, we listen back to an interview with Susie Rodolo about the 4 years Bob Dylan was her boyfriend and about the photo she appeared in with Dylan that was on the cover of his 1963 album, The Freewheelin' Bob Dylan. Susie Rodolo died Friday at the age of 67. This is Fresh Air. Susie Rodolo had a pretty private life as an artist, wife, and mother, but there was one thing she was famous for which made her the subject of mystery and speculation. She appeared in the picture with Bob Dylan on the cover of his famous 1963 album, The Freewheelin' Bob Dylan. The album included the songs Blowin' in the Wind, A Hard Rain's Gonna Fall, and Don't Think Twice. Susie Rodolo died Friday of lung cancer at the age of 67.
Well, it ain't no use to sit and wonder why, baby, even you don't know by now. And it ain't no use to sit and wonder why, baby, it'll never do somehow. When your rooster crows at the break of dawn, look out your window and I'll be gone. You're the reason I'm traveling on, but don't think twice, it's all right.
The cover photo of The Freewheelin' Bob Dylan showed Dylan and Susie Rodolo walking arm in arm down a Greenwich Village street. They met when she was 17 and he was 20. They were a couple for about 4 years. She'd moved to Greenwich Village from Queens, New York, on her own after graduating high school. Dylan moved there soon after. At the time, the village was the epicenter of the urban folk scene. Rodolo was an artist. She later taught at the Parsons School of Design. She lived in Greenwich Village with her husband. I spoke with her in 2008, after the publication of her memoir, A Freewheelin' Time, a memoir of Greenwich Village in the 60s. In Dylan's biographical book, Chronicles, Volume 1, he writes about you in the end of the book, and I want to read some of the things he says about you. He says, right from the start, I couldn't take my eyes off her. She was the most erotic thing I'd ever seen. She was fair-skinned and golden-haired, full-blood Italian. The air was suddenly filled with banana leaves. We started talking, and my head started to spin. Cupid's arrow had whistled by my ears before, but this time it hit me in the heart, and the weight of it dragged me overboard. Susie was 17 years old, from the East Coast, had grown up in Queens, raised in a left-wing family. Her father had worked in a factory and had recently died. She was involved in the New York art scene, painted and made drawings for various publications, worked in graphic design and in off-Broadway theatrical productions, also worked on civil rights committees. She could do a lot of things. Meeting her was like stepping into the tales of 1001 Arabian Nights. And then he compares her to a Rodin sculpture come to life and says, she reminded me of a libertine heroine. She was just my type. What? How does that description sound to you? Do you hear yourself in that description?
I think that's wonderful and generous and a lovely thing that he wrote. And he captured that sense of being young and meeting somebody and being overwhelmed by feelings for them. And that's what young love is. He did that well.
Everyone knows now that Bob Dylan was born Robert Zimmerman and he grew up in Minnesota. What did he tell you about his past when you met him?
Well, at that time when I met him, I think it was the time when people were coming to the village to find or lose themselves, and you live very much in the present. So I don't think any of us really talked about where we came from and what our parents were like. But there were rumors that that was his name because he had to get a cabaret card and then you had to have documentation. So rumors started flying that it wasn't his real name. I think a lot of people suspected it wasn't his real name, but it didn't make any difference. But for me, once we were a couple and we were together, I was hurt that he didn't tell me. It was okay. He didn't tell everybody else.
So how did you find out that his last name was actually Zimmerman?
We had come home. We were living together on West 4th Street, and we had come home one evening, and he was a bit in his cups, and he took his wallet out of his pants, and everything fell on the floor, and I saw his draft card. There were draft cards in those days. And I saw his name, and I was really, that's when I was hurt. I said, you never told me that this was your real name. I understand you didn't tell anybody else, but you could have at least told me.
No, you said that, you know, just as he didn't want to be too forthcoming about his upbringing and his family, you felt the same way too. But you were from Queens, New York, and your parents were both communists, and you had to grow up with some secrecy because you grew up during the McCarthy era. So
exactly.
You couldn't very well go around talking about your communist parents.
No, I couldn't until 1989. I didn't feel comfortable saying that. So that was why, to give you an idea of how secrecy would make sense in something like that, I could understand people not wanting to talk about their story. And you didn't go around saying that your parents were communists, because what was from the McCarthy era into the 60s certainly left its mark. And I'm sure there were many others with communist parents, certainly in the folk music world, but we didn't even identify each other. You know, it was a secret thing.
Let's talk about the cover. The now famous cover from the Freewheelin' Bob Dylan, the cover that you're on with him walking down a partially snow-covered street. He has his hands in his pockets and his shoulders up because it's cold, and you have your arms wrapped around one of his arms. You're wearing like a green trench coat that's tied around the waist, and you have nearly knee-high boots.
Mm-hmm.
And you look really in tune with each other. It's such a romantic cover. I mean, what woman didn't want to be on Dylan's arm in that cover? What woman didn't want to be in your place? So tell us how that cover came to be.
It was all very casual, and the apartment was very small, and the photographer came and the publicity guy from Columbia came. So then they figured they'd start taking some pictures in the apartment of Bob, sitting around, pick up your guitar, put it down, sing something. And then Don Hunstein said to me, get in some of the pictures. So I did, and he took more pictures. And then he said, let's go outside and walk. It was very casual, completely unplanned. And it was freezing outside. And then again, referring to Bob getting dressed, he just took this thin suede jacket that wasn't good for a New York cold winter day. And I had on a couple of sweaters. The last one was his, a big bulky knit sweater, because the apartment was cold. And I threw on a coat on top. So I always look at that picture as I feel like an Italian sausage because I had so many layers on. And he was freezing, and I was freezing and had more clothes on. It was very cold that day.
Well, he was freezing, you say, in part because he wore this light suede jacket because it looked good.
Image.
Even though he knew he was going to be really cold.
Yeah.
How did that album cover change your life?
I had no idea, and I don't think anyone who had anything to do with it thought it would have such an enormous impact. So it became something that was, you know, it was my identifier, but it wasn't my identity. So it became something that was separate from who I knew myself to be, which might sound odd, but I thought it was a great cover, a very unusual cover for the time. And the first time I saw it was, he was playing at Carnegie Hall, I think, or Town Hall, and the cover was blown up and put on right outside. It was in black and white and blown up very big. And that really made an impression. It was almost embarrassing. There we were up on 57th Street. Huge, huge. So each time the album began more and more known, as the album became more what it is, it became an iconic album, the more I could detach from it and just look at it, okay, that's what that is. But it was an odd feeling for many years.
I think one of the problems for young women who fall in love with men older, even if they're just slightly older, particularly if that man becomes very famous, is that you risk this kind of mentor-mentee relationship where, you know, the woman is expected to be the learner looking up to the man, and he teaches her everything he knows. And it could really be a kind of uncomfortable relationship, as opposed to like a relationship of equals. But when you and Dylan met, you had so much to learn from each other. I mean, you really admired his music and had so much to learn from that. He was really interested in learning about your world. You were working in the civil rights movement. You were working in avant-garde theater. He learned about the music of Weill and Brecht through the fact that you were working on a Brecht production. And he writes in his memoir about how it really changed him to be exposed to that music. You exposed him to art that he was unaware of because you were an artist yourself. I was glad to see that, to see how much you had to learn from each other.
That's nice, because it's true. We did. We were very curious, and we were both in search of poetry. And we fed each other's curiosity. And I was, well, because I was from New York City also, you know, and he was from Hibbing, Minnesota. So the fact that in New York you're exposed to a lot more, plus the family I came from, we didn't have much money, but we were very culturally, I always think of it as being culturally very, very wealthy because, books we had, we didn't have a TV, but the house was filled with books and phonograph records, and we listened to the radio. I was exposed to all different kinds of music from a very early age. My mother loved Bessie Smith, Billie Holiday, and Edith Piaf, and they listened to opera, classical records we had. It was very, very rich, and when you grow up in that, you just assume everybody else knows all this. But I knew an awful lot about music just from listening and hearing and being exposed to it, whereas with Bob, he heard this music and knew this is what he wanted to investigate, but he had a harder time finding it and finding people. And there are stories now about he would, when he was in Minnesota, stealing people's records so he could learn the music on it. So he had a harder time finding things, whereas I was almost born into it.
You decided to leave for Perugia, Italy. You were supposed to go there after high school. You'd had a trip planned, but because of a car accident, you never made it. And then you moved to Greenwich Village, and then you met Dylan and so on. But the opportunity was offered to you again by your mother. So you decided to leave for Perugia. It was a very difficult decision for you. What was his reaction when you told him you were going?
Well, he didn't want me to go, but at the same time, he didn't want to put pressure on me. He did say, don't go, but he didn't want to restrict me from considering going at the same time. And it was a difficult decision for me. I kept hemming and hawing on whether I should or shouldn't or whether I wanted to or not. It was difficult.
Is the song Boots of Spanish Leather written about your leaving for Italy?
You know, most of the songs that he's written, I hate to say, oh, this is written about me or this, but that's a good example of a song that is a fiction based on an experience he was going through.
And the experience he was going through was the experience of missing you?
Yes. So that's a good example of how it becomes art. Your life experience, you translate it into art. It serves a purpose for the music you're making or the art you're making.
So the fiction is that you weren't in Spain, you were in Italy, and did he ever ask for boots of Spanish leather?
No. I think I had a pair, though, of boots of Spanish leather at some point.
After about 8 months in Perugia, you came back to Greenwich Village, and you write that during your absence, he suffered in public. You didn't get a friendly reception when you returned. A lot of people, you say, thought that you'd been cold and indifferent to someone who loved you, and that some of the folk singers deliberately sang songs that Dylan had written about his heartache, as well as any ballad that pointed a finger at a cruel lover when you were around.
Yeah.
And you say it was as if every letter Bob had written to me and every phone call he had made had been performed in a theater in front of an audience. What do you mean by that?
I've always been a shy person, so to have this relationship kind of thrown right out there in public was very horrible. I thought it was terrible that I was very private. I didn't go broadcasting things around, and yet people seemed to know how I had made him suffer. Publicly, he was letting that out. But I see that that was just his way of working through it, making it a part of his art. But at the time, I just felt so exposed. It was awful.
Well, you moved back to Greenwich Village, and you got together, but then you eventually moved out of the apartment that you shared with Dylan. What was the breaking point for you?
It was all this stuff that was going on around his fame, and there was so much pressure. I just felt that there was no longer had a place in this world of this music and fame, and I more and more felt more and more insecure that I was just a string on his guitar, I was just this chick, and I was losing confidence in who I was and the way I felt in Italy, that I was my own self and could continue my life. And also, the more famous he got, there were more pressures on him, and of course there's all these women that were running around, and so it became something that I didn't like being involved anymore. I saw it as a small, cloistered, specialized world that I just didn't belong in it.
You're married. You have one child?
Yes.
And your husband's Italian. Did you meet him when you were in Perugia?
Initially, yes. I had met him all that long time ago, but then we met up again many years later. So it's funny that he came from a certain time also. Yeah, and then we met again many years later.
Do people still recognize you from the Freewheelin' album?
I look exactly the same, Terry.
Yeah, don't we all?
Yes.
But, you know, still it doesn't mean you're not recognizable.
Well, for those who notice those things, yes. I mean, otherwise, no. I mean, it's a funny kind of recognition. It's people who are Dylan Files, you know, Dylan O'Files, or however I could say that, would know to recognize the name, but not everybody does. So it's kind of a funny, sometimes I'm surprised that someone recognizes me.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure to speak to you.
Susie Rotolo died Friday of lung cancer at the age of 67. Our interview was recorded in 2008 after the publication of her memoir, A Freewheelin' Time, a memoir of Greenwich Village in the 60s.
Oh, I'm sailing away, my own true love. I'm sailing away in the morning. Is it something I can send you from across the sea? From the place that I'll be landing.
You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer today is Fred Snyder. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our associate producer for online media is Melody Kramer. Roberta Schirach directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
I'm across that lonesome ocean. Ah, but I just thought you might want something fine, made of silver or of gold.